everyone. This is Lena Live. I'm Lena Mirmond. I have exceptionally rare opportunity to speak with an outstanding internationally known author, thinker, philosopher, and some other qualities which we will be discussing in our program. And her name is Miss Lynn McTaggart. Her last book, The Bond, truly created a tremendous amount of reaction. It is almost an explosion in intellectual, philosophical world with a scientific vision and with our everyday consciousness, how we see the world, what is necessary for us to revision ourselves and the world, and how to find ourselves with will to connect rather than to compete. Lynn, it is my greatest pleasure to invite you to the conversation. I hope I can call you by your first name.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
Well, thank you. And I would not want to proceed with this usual question-answer format. I like to exchange more with ideas. And mm-hmm. the first one, if we can start before we will go to some chapters and some just incredibly fascinating descriptions and examples from the history and humankind, I'd like to ask you, how did you come to this extremely profound conceptual realization that it is just now and it is very moment for such a profound book to be written?
Oh, thank you. Well, I really came about because I was trying to figure out why, you know, whether we're supposed to be competitive. It really had a personal thing. Well, two things. Had a personal beginning, which was one of my daughters is very good in drama, and she had been chosen for her the main part in her school play. And all of a sudden, she was shunted to a more minor role. And I could never find out the reason until one of her friends let slip that another girl had lied to take over her place. And that girl, by the way, was one of her best friends. And so I was shocked by this. And I tried to bring it up tactfully with the mother one day. And the mother turned to me and said, well, that's life, isn't it? And you know, that took me aback, but I started thinking about it, and I thought, yeah, she's right. That is life. That's the life we adults have certainly created for ourselves, and it's small wonder that our children are doing it too. So that was one reason for its genesis, and the other reason really had to do with the fact that I wanted to ask myself a really basic question, because I started seeing so much crisis around us. You know, the ecological crises, financial crises, terrorist crises, crises of food, crises of water, crises of everything. And I wondered what this was all about. And it seemed to me that something was wrong, that if we were meant to be competitive, well, this is the end stage of, this is what competition looks like at the very end. It looks like every man for himself, and there certainly isn't enough to go around. And so, because some people are taking everything and other people have nothing. So I wanted to ask, was it meant to be like this? And that was really the question I was asking with The Bond. Were we meant to be like this? Were we meant to be so competitive? And, you know, and the resounding answer is no. You know, we're acting against our nature, and that's why we're in such a mess. When we act with our nature, which is to share, care, and be fair, then we thrive. But when we don't, we turn into what we've got today.
I certainly was very much touched by that story which you just expressed. In fact, that's how you start in your book. And I was somewhat pleasantly confused because I was expecting immediately power of a very strong, comprehensive description of our times. And I was that much more fascinated by the fact that this book almost like an institution where smallest but not any less of importance details connected to the most important fundamental laws of the history and science. I like to ask you, how do you see the connection between, for example, vision of science of our today's world and science which existed before? You described some very interesting experiment with a monkey and that Italian scientist who noticed that monkeys' neurons reaction will be the same whether it's a monkey's action herself or reaction to others. So how would you say that vision of these scientific phenomenal experiments are changed today?
Well, I think that those experiments, the experiments you're talking about, which were conducted with Giacomo Rizzolatti, he was just looking at monkeys and how they work with movement. And he was trying to figure out what neural patterns happen when a monkey wants to reach out and grasp something. And what he noticed was the neural movements occurred, the very same ones occurred, whether the monkey was reaching and grasping or whether one of the researchers was doing the reaching and grasping. And Rizzolatti was thunderstruck when he realized the implications. It meant that our neurons fire when we are, the same neurons fire when we're witnessing an action as when we're performing the action ourselves. And he went on to study emotion, and he found the very same thing occurred. When we watch somebody else have an emotion, the very same neurons fire in us as if we have the emotion ourselves. So he realized this is how we understand the world. We understand the world by imitating it. But also there's a bigger thing here, which is simply that we understand the world in a sense by merging with it. And so the real implications here are quite profound. They mean that, you know, when we think our thoughts are my own, actually our thoughts are a complicated mix of the actions and emotions of other people and our own thrown into the brew. So, you know, this is part of what my argument is in the first part of the book, which is that there's no such thing as true individuality. You know, individuality doesn't exist. In fact, even things don't exist.
I immediately made a connection on my own. In fact, I will interrupt my thought, taking advantage that we have this very informal conversation, and I would say that I personally had a little bit of the competition between reading and thinking at the same time. So I had to stop for a moment and get back to the phrase before and the thought before and connect to my own present understanding. And that's why it's constantly forth and back connections. So the way you wrote this book is in such a superb form that indeed the style of it proving its purpose, because I constantly was forced to connect not only with a thought, but with my own personal observation. In fact, I think you're making in one place in a book a wonderful difference between being observed and being in a stage of observation, and we're constantly changing this mode. But all of this I'm bringing to the relationship between parents and children, because I think the parents' action is the most vivid example to the children's imagination and children's learning process, because parents not necessarily need to do things. They can show the word or the gesture, and children couldn't be more observant than any kind of a most sensitive organism. So I believe that even if child doesn't have much of the word saying to his or her parents at a given moment, but just observing the behavior of the parent will give a tremendous message, just like this monkey had a message from the other person.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Well, this is, you know, this is how we blend with other people. And the point here really is that when we think of ourselves as individual, we think of our bodies as being individual. We think of our thoughts as being our own. We think of ourselves as being entirely the captain of our own ship. And the point of my book, the first part of my book, is that that's not true. We're so interconnected with people on every level, from subatomic particles to cells, to our genes and the environment, to our understanding of other people through these mirror neurons, to the sun and its activity and its effect upon us. Between all of these things, there is a bond, which is a connection so profound and integral that it's impossible to say where one thing ends and another thing begins. And so that bond means that we're constantly basically having bits of other people and other parts in with our own. So the idea that we're this wholly enclosed and self-contained entity is a complete fiction. It's not true. We're constantly merging with other people. We're constantly part of a bigger whole in everything we do. And we're made only because of the our environment. Our environment affects our genes and determines what gets turned on. We're invented, if you will, from outside in.
Right from your first chapter, the superorganism, there is a very profound thought of one thinker, Norman Mailer. In fact, you put this thought right in the beginning. Everything is getting smaller and smaller and less important. I have this in front of me, and frankly, when I read this, I had another thought, that there is a tremendous confusion because material things becoming bigger and bigger, but our intellectual abilities for the appreciation of our emotional connections and other relationship connections, which you're talking about, indeed becoming smaller and smaller. Many people are concerned about this, and they're scared, but they don't have enough courage to speak about this, or maybe they don't know how. And there is a certainly very profound answer in your book, in the numerous multi-levels of that. And one of what you just said is inner relationship and inner connection. I'd like to go a little bit deeper into sense of fear, because people are feeling much lonelier than they've been, and they indeed quite scared. Where one could start to visualize and to make some conceptual connections and start to feel more part of the world rather than a disconnected entity.
Okay, well, one of the things that I really wrote this book for was not simply to say, okay, everybody, this is what selfish looks like, because that's where we've come to. You know, we've come to a position where we feel lonely and disconnected, and we feel everything is getting smaller and smaller, because our understanding of the world is atomizing, as I use it, I use that phrase. It's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and only about us and actually our immediate family, and sometimes not even that. And so I wanted to show, okay, this is what it looks like when we act against nature. You know, we are getting more and more broken apart, more and more individualistic, more and more individual. But that's not the way we were programmed to be. And there is this other way, and it's not that hard to shift. It means some retraining, but we have to shift in a number of things. We need to shift just in the way we see. Because right now, you know, we talk about, oh, we're all one. But we've been programmed and trained to see things very individualistically. We've been programmed and trained to see the world as a collection of things. And we're also always looking for the main point, the main thing, and looking at things in relationship to us. And so when we do that, we tend to isolate our vision so much, and we don't see the whole. I'll give you an example of that. the Moken. They were one of four tribes that watched the devastation at the 2004 tsunami, which killed a quarter of a million people. They were one of the four tribes that sat and watched the whole thing from the safe haven of the top of the mountain. Now, they had, a couple of the elders of the tribe had noticed a few things, and they had realized a tsunami was about to hit, and they warned the rest of their tribe. Well, when they were asked, how on earth did you know? They answered things like this. Well, the fish were swimming in a little funny way, and the animals were acting a little peculiarly, and the wind was blowing in a slightly different direction, and all of this gave some of the elders the clue that the water was going to hurl back and then and send forward with fury. So it was that kind of noticing of subtle detail that really characterizes that culture. They're able to even see underwater at great distances without any visual aids like goggles. And this is culturally induced. They learn to see with a better pair of eyes. They see in the space between things. And by what I mean by that is they see interrelation and interconnection. We don't. We're taught when we're young to just look for individual things. You know, when we read books, when we read our first books, we read things like Fun with Dick and Jane, where we're taught to examine and look for the coming and goings of an individual. You know, see Dick run. And yet other cultures, like the Japanese, for instance, they're taught to see things in connection. For instance, their first books would be something like this. They'd have Big Brother and Little Brother sitting there, and they would say, here is Big Brother and Little Brother. Little Brother loves Big Brother. Big Brother looks after Little Brother. And so they're taught to think about a relationship as the fundamental unit. And that really tends to govern the way they see, so that if we had a student of American student and, say, a Japanese student in front of the Mona Lisa, the American student would notice the face first and foremost, and primarily the face, whereas a Japanese student would notice the figure in relationship to its environment, because they've been taught much more about the environment and the interrelationship between things. And so in a way, the figure would shrink in size, in a sense, and become just part of its background. So that kind of governing of the way we see really also informs the way we relate to people. You know, when we look at people, we see everybody in relation to us, and we ask a question like, what's in it for me? Whereas, you know, other cultures, like the Moken, see relationships in a different way. And because they do that, and because they're able to see so much detail, they can allow for contradiction and difference of opinion and differences, and understand and allow for more than one view of reality.
I just wanted to make sure that whoever joined us a little later, I have privilege to have very distinguished guest, author and thinker Lynn McTaggart, whose book The Bond literally changed our vision, and it became culmination not only among her own six brilliantly written books. I believe it is a climbing point for many other books which have been written on the subject. Subject of a great concern for all of us as a society, as an individual, and mostly important, it is very important for our future generation, our children. I'd like to bring something to the discussion, the idea of connection from a little bit different point of view. You just mentioned the difference of the perception of American student, for example, and Japanese. So we're talking about, I would call it bouquet of cultural perception. I think, in a sense, we should go back a little bit to have a little bit smell of Renaissance, Baroque, where this all started, where people used to worship the family traditions without even writing or talking about this. Unfortunately, digital world, which is so incredibly fast, in music we call it prestissimo, makes and creates profound conflict for our emotional process, for our intellectual space. And I think the challenge which you described in your book is so sharp, especially now, because indeed we're competing not only with ourselves, but with the technology, which is most ridiculous, unfair, and I would say lack of any physiological nature competition. How do you see us leveling and controlling this madness?
Controlling the technology or controlling...
Yeah. Controlling our reaction to it. I call it the madness when we're trying to compete our abilities and our progress. And when we falsely think that because we have a high technology, we have tremendous human progress, when indeed it is two different things.
Okay. Well, this is the conceit of Western man, is to believe, is to equate technological advancement with wisdom. And one of the problems with technology is that it has brought to us it's brought to us brilliant ease and advancement in that way, you know, with washing machines and telephones. And, you know, I speak to you right now because of technology and computers and all the wonderful things that we have in that sense. But they are also, to some extent, the instruments of a certain amount of alienation, because one of the problems that we have is that all of our technology and all of our whole society is built upon this whole idea that we must compete to survive. And that competition, that mindset, has really broken down so many of the things that really make for happy and a progressive human existence, neighborhoods, relationships, children doing well, happy relations at work. All of those things are going by the board because of competition. So technologically, I mean, you know, I'm not one of these people who is a Luddite who believes that we should never use any technology because it's the road to hell. I think that what's very interesting about what's going on now is the power of the internet, and the internet in bringing people together, in even people who are, you know, are very far away physically, are able to communicate around the world. And so that brings the world very much closer. So we can use this technology to a very advanced degree, but we should never expect that it's going to take the place of important human values, and also understand that we have created this kind of technology because of our great need for connection, because we're at a point now where connection is broken in so many ways. So it's kind of interesting that this is the point where we've substituted it with cyber connection.
Speaking about technology and some scientific points, if I got this clearly, you made an emphasis of three fundamental events which took place and somewhat revolutionized the mental perception of the world. You've been talking about scientific revolution, or the age of enlightenment, you've been talking about industrial revolution, and then you've been talking about discovering of DNA. And you made extremely detailed and very scrupulous description how all of that made an impact on us as a human being. Could you just give some thoughts from your book? Because you certainly will do it better than I would, but I was so deeply impressed with this connection and how we can find ourselves in this progress, and how can we find ourselves in the connection with the presence relating to where we came from. So if you can elaborate on this and bring some
sure.
thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Well, What I was writing about was how the scientific story came to be, how we came to believe that we are separate and competitive, because, you know, we live by a certain narrative in our lives, a certain story, and many things write that story, whether it's religion or philosophy, but probably the biggest author of all is science. You know, we really respect and believe what science tells us about who we are and how we're supposed to live. And the scientific story that we live by now was started several centuries ago, about 3.5 centuries ago, with the findings of Isaac Newton, who described a world of individual and well-behaved things. I mean, prior to that, the universe was considered much more of a holistic whole. And so he described this place of a lot of separate and unrelated things. And then this got emphasized in a kind of machine mentality because, you know, man moved from, and woman, moved from living in an agrarian society to an industrial society where life was not governed by the seasons but by the punching in of a clock. You know, we became, in a sense, machines in the way we worked after the arrival of the biggest machine of all, the steam engine. And then we then had our view of ourselves and our lives complicated and bolstered by the second industrial revolution, which brought in, you know, modern manufacturing and all of the modern metals and all of the modern equipment, essentially, and also by the discoveries of Charles Darwin. And now, Darwin never actually said the term survival of the fittest. He never coined that term. That was his friends, and one friend in particular, and they acted as his mouthpiece, and they spread around this idea. Darwin himself initially was very influenced by Malthus, who wrote about population explosion, and he believed that life essentially operated by struggle. But he meant it in much more of a metaphoric sense, how a tree root struggles to find water. But nevertheless, that coined term, survival of the fittest, stuck, and the very strict view of the metaphor was adopted by a lot of burgeoning movements, including capitalism. So it made for a very good fit, the idea that, you know, that the person does best for society by looking out for number one. So all of those thoughts really came together at the same time of a number of movements and really swept the globe and then became an integral part of our thinking about who we are, so that now that whole idea of competition has permeated our everyday. It is behind the huge raft of cheating that goes on in corporate America now. The 60% of college students who cheat on their exams to get ahead. It is used as a rationale for sociopathic behavior. I mean, at the Columbine High killings, one of the murderers who walked in there with all kinds of semi-automatic rifles was wearing a natural selection T-shirt. So this mindset that life is a struggle and life is a race to the finish line has really, as I say, it's the warp and woof of our lives now. It's become the leitmotif of our lives, and it's so permeated into every way that we think that we have to dissemble it in order to retrain ourselves. We have to understand, and that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to write a new story, to correct the story, because this real story is not about that. Even Darwin himself recognized this. He realized later in his life that the real essential operation in nature was cooperation, not competition. And we see that more and more in every aspect of our lives. Nature drives us to wholeness. Nature wants us to connect. It makes it feel good to connect, to belong, to share, care, and be fair above all else. So nature does not have a drive for dominion. It has a drive for connection.
I will be very modest, but I have to confess you made my intellectual mattress so comfortable that I will express my own personal thoughts, which I sometimes share with some students. I would say that in my personal understanding, the more connections and associations one individual can make, the more talented and genius she or he can become. I don't know if you can agree with this abstract formulation, but I believe strongly that the more resourceful we are inside, that means the more abilities we have to connect with different levels of outside world.
Well, yes. Well, that's the point, is that we are made to connect on many levels. And the problem is that we need to retrain ourselves. You know, rediscovering the bond is really important for all of us for one particular reason. At the moment, life is at its most unfair in America and in elsewhere in the West. We have 1% of the population owning and controlling 40% of the money. We have 1% of the population owning, in a sense, laws that that favor the 1% and don't favor the 99%. And we have 1 in 39 people in America is a millionaire, but 39 million people live below the poverty line. So this unfairness has huge repercussions for everybody, rich and poor, because when life is this unfair, when there's so little opportunity for one segment and so total opportunity for another, everybody loses, rich and poor. The in every social indicator, the more unfair a society, the worse off people are in terms of health care, violence statistics, crime and violence, mental health, education, you name it. And at the moment, America is at the bottom on all of those indicators. It has the worst of all Western countries in terms of education, health, etc., despite being one of the richest countries in the world, if not the richest country. And so everybody loses when we don't live the bond. And right now, one of the things that we have intrinsically inside us is a sense of fairness. We were meant to be fair. We were meant to take our turn. That's hardwired in our brains. And when we aren't, we have a little alarm bell that goes off in our brains, and it's not fair alarm bell. So because we're at our unfairest in history, we are going to experience more and more crises unless we change. And so the other part of the bond is to offer some very simple ways to change, because we think that our crises have to be handled from the top down, from the people in charge. But that's not true. I believe it's going to happen the other way. It's going to happen from the bottom up. And the reason I wrote The Bond was to offer simple ways to retrain and a signposting of what's most important to retrain so that you can recover connection in your life. And you can recover better relationships, a better neighborhood, a closer neighborhood, a more closer and more productive, and more and a workforce wedded to teamwork and connection, and also that you have more of a sense of purpose in your life, because right now our only purpose seems to be what's in it for me. And we can do better than this. We were meant to do better than this.
Lynn, I apologize, and I'm glad to ask you about your schedule. I know you have tremendously busy schedule and schedule of your touring with the book, and thankfully you are also going to be in the United States. Actually, you're going to be in New York area, which was pleasant discovery for me. But for now, I just wanted to make sure that we can continue our conversation and that you don't have any other obligations, so we can go on.
No, we can go on. We can go on for another half hour.
Oh, wonderful. Courage. That is something which is so incredibly pronounced in your book. And comes in mind one thought that I don't remember exactly where I read about this, but because I do teach psychology of the performance, this thought sometime comes to my mind and it came now. And the thought is that courage is not the absence of fear, but it is the judgment that something else is more important than fear. I believe that reading your book, as I mentioned in my own experience, there is a whole scale of thoughts. It's you not only touched sensitive buttons, but you touched most profound thinking, which was put on a shelf and was not entertained for some time. And I believe that everyone who reads your book goes through his or her own laboratory of human perception. And certainly courage is one of the quality which today is very important, especially when you're talking about changes. Changes are the hardest thing, and one needs to be convinced of ways and methods to perform this change. How would we put courage on a scale of vision? How it can help us to motivate ourselves, to motivate our young children, to go through perhaps being different, but being right, and not to be afraid to say no when everyone would say yes. Where in the book are you expressing that?
I think I'm expressing that when I talk about being a game changer. And by that I mean this. We don't have to be quite worried about being different, because people have an incredible need to agree. I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me about studying the real scientific story, the new scientific story, was to find out how much people need to belong together, to agree with each other, to give to each other, to be fair with each other. Those qualities are really in every single human being. And this thing about agreeing with each other, I mean, if you were sitting across from me and you were watching me speak, your blinking and your hand movements would be syncopated with my voice. You would be marking time in a way with all of your bodily movements to my voice, because we're connecting all the time like that whenever we communicate. And another thing that happens too, which is emotions themselves become like viruses. If I walk into the room and I'm in a happy mood, I'm more likely to make people happy. If I'm in a bad mood, I'm more likely to make people unhappy. And people have studied this. People like Siegel Bersaad have studied what she calls the ripple effect. And she discovered this because she was in her office one day and she'd realized that this normally testy and negative office was very positive. People were stopping and chatting and saying hello much more than usual. And she couldn't figure out what was the difference until she realized that there had been one of her coworkers, who is normally very grumpy and curmudgeonly, was on holiday. And so when she realized that this woman was on vacation, the whole mood had lifted. And it stayed lifted until this woman came back. And when she came back, the office descended into its negative attitude once again. So she recognized that emotions are like viruses, and they can infect, you know, a whole area. other scientists have realized that this kind of emotional infection not only happens to people around you, but that gets passed down networks. So that if I'm nice to you, for instance, if I'm happy, I might affect you and you'll be more happier, but you're also going to affect your friends, your friends' friends, your friends' friends' friends. And so an experience of positive or negative emotion becomes viral, just like an internet. So what I would say to people about courage is have the courage to have to try to reprogram, but also have the faith in the new story, because what we also have found is that if you are nice to someone, if you are generous to someone, if you act and in a pay-it-forward manner, you do some random act of kindness to someone, that's more likely to affect their friends, their friends' friends, their friends' friends' friends. They will pay it forward. Their friends will pay it forward. Their friends' friends will pay it forward. And so it goes on in a virus, too. So new behavior, what I'm saying, according to the bond, new behavior that honors connection, not competition, also becomes viral.
You have two chapters. By the way, the names of your chapters are so incredibly sharp, concise, and immediately shifting your mental tonus to what you're going to say. I was admiring the titles of each chapter. There are two chapters. One has a title, Born to Agree, and another one, Born to Give. I'll be honest with you, Born to Agree starts with quite an impressive, somewhat intimidating description of one incident. Could you share this, which has to do with the cemetery?
Oh, yes. Well, this was, happened in Scotland. And one afternoon, as soon as the schools let out at 3 o'clock, virtually the whole of this area near Glasgow emptied of children from school, and they all started running toward a cemetery. And they were all carrying broken bits of, you know, sticks and anything else they could find as a homemade weapon. And a policeman was called to this disturbance because there were loads and loads of them that were combing the cemetery up until dusk. And when he tried to find out what it was, he discovered both the children and some of the parents who were with them were hunting a 7-foot vampire, which they had been told had eaten several of the children. Now, this had spread like wildfire from one child to another, and almost without a decision to do so, they all went as one toward the cemetery. It's an example of what they've called, what scientists call or psychologists call, mass psychogenic illness. And what it actually is the fact that we can easily create the identical feeling in another person, so much so that it can lead to this kind of hysterical behavior. I mean, that was the issue behind the Salem witchcraft trials. One girl thought she saw witches and fainted, and all of a sudden so many of the other teenagers of the town did the same thing, and they began accusing some of the honest townspeople of being witches. So that kind of behavior really stems from what I was talking about before, the fact that emotions and actions become virulent like viruses and can affect all of us, and that we imitate each other from that need to come together, our need to agree.
That was particularly very impressive to myself because it involved children. And I would say that power of imagination is probably the most incredible fuel for the child's development and child's imagination. And frankly, it pains me to know that America a number of years ago was a leading institution on every frontier of education. We still have, in a very high level, Ivy League schools. there are still absolute brilliant brains and some fantastically gifted students. But bottom education is suffering tremendously. I believe that there is an incredible message in your book where, again, one can start from very simple thing. And I think, I believe you're talking about this, that just to use simple moments of some kind of a mental visualization, maybe not necessarily meditation in a formal sense of the word, but a certain habit, certain self-reprogramming, as I understand some other people can do. What is your, if not recommendation, but what is your position? How to go about for someone who is deeply motivated to make a change and yet feel absolutely stuck, feel that no matter what I try with my talent, with my, again, courage, I understand what I read, but I just don't quite know where to start, because no matter where I start, I will not be understood. How would we go on an individual level to form the new connection?
Okay, well, the first way is just to understand you don't have to start with big ideas. You have to start with small ideas. And as I mentioned in the book, the four areas of needing to be retrained are how we see differently. We have to start learning how to see holistically. We need to learn how to relate differently, so we're not relating just for what's in it for me, but relating with the view to whatever I have to do to make this connection, honoring the connection that's always there despite any superficial differences. Also, organizing differently in my neighborhood, my workplace, creating a bigger goal that everybody can join in with, so that differences don't matter, and once again, we connect because of our common humanity. And finally, changing my purpose so that my purpose is really making those connections every day, not just making money, making whatever I have to make that's what's in it for me. When you change your perspective on those four things, you start changing radically. But you start simple way to start noticing more in your life are a simple practice of coming into your body three or four times a day. Some cultures call this mindfulness meditation. What it really means is you're not focusing on thinking. You simply come into your body and experience the moment in your senses. So let's say you're eating your cornflakes. Instead of thinking about what's going to happen today or pondering about what happened yesterday, you come into your body and you notice what your body is feeling when you're eating your cornflakes. You know, what does it smell like? What does it taste like? What does it sound like? What does it look like? You know, what does it feel like when it goes down your throat? Connect with the five senses and just do that four or five times a day. Just different points of the day, just come into your senses and notice in exquisite detail. And the scientific studies show that within a few weeks, you will begin to notice more. Now, that's really important because when you start noticing more, you start noticing different views of reality, and you're more able to allow them to exist because you recognize that there are common connections. You recognize much more, and you see the world as a bigger whole. So that's one really important thing to do, but there are many, many others I talk about in my book, and a lot of it has to do with a change of perspective. The other thing that's really important to understand is that this whole idea of becoming a positive social virus isn't tough. There was a woman in an office who was tired of the greedy and selfish nature of her office, and so she decided that every day, when she had her coffee break and went to the Coke machine, she would leave some change in the change place. And she wrote a little sign that said, "Your Coke has been paid for. Pay it forward." Now, this completely unsettled her office at first. They began to create, they sent emails around all the members of the staff to try to figure out who this Secret Santa was. They began spying on the Coke machine like a neighborhood watch scheme. They took turns. And she got wind of this, so she moved to another floor and began leaving donuts. And this and every day, leaving a little note again, pay it, your donuts have been, you know, left for you, pay it forward. So once again, this completely changed the conversation in that office. This completely changed the connection there and the culture of the organization. So that one little action had an enormous ripple effect. So this is the idea that when you make the bond your purpose, you come up with tiny creative actions that change the whole game in your circle.
We're going to jump to your last chapter, which you already touched upon now, Paid Forward. But you mention in a very eloquent way some holistic, some meditative moments. And of course, one would connect to Deepak Chopra, who was one of your strongest admirers. In fact, he was among many who admired your book and New York Times best-selling authors endorsed your book in many levels. I honestly would say that just reading those endorsements being so impressive, one could have already some sense and some main melodies of your book, because it was not just properly well-crafted sentences. It was deeply expressive thoughts and very personal ones. So I have to say that you played every little and big instrument in a huge orchestra. you didn't miss.
Thank you very much. That's very kind.
You didn't miss anything. And just harmoniously concluding our discussion, I think we didn't touch enough one discipline, I would say, of thinking. It's a space in between, because with quite eloquence and clarity, you made a very clear point how important it is to realize, to sense, and to honor the space. Could you please share with us your concept regarding that?
Yes. Well, when by space in between, what I mean is the connection itself, the relationship, because, you know, we see this with subatomic particles, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, they're not a thing, they're a relationship. When we start to think that way about other people and realize they're not just a thing there for our benefit, but our connection changes everything and makes that a relationship all in itself. And when we put that relationship first and change our point of view so that we, when we have another person and we say to ourselves, what is it that I need to do to allow this person to thrive? What do I need to do to honor this relationship? When you start taking it from that perspective, everything changes. I give you an example. There's a guy called Orland Bishop who's working with these groups, the Crips and the Bloods, who are gangs, and they're members of the most violent gangs in America, and he's teaching them how to relate to each other. I mean, this would seem to be a fool's errand, but he's doing it really successfully because he's showing them that when you have a connection with someone, when you speak with someone, it's not all about winning a debate or an argument or prevailing or dominating or even stabbing them or shooting them. It's about just making that connection. And he teaches them to really speak their own truth, to speak what's really important to them, honestly, and has the other person honestly listen. And it's changing the whole game there. It's changing the culture there in Watts, one of the most dangerous places in America. And it's the same kind of way of speaking that is, it's called dialogue. And it's about not using someone for personal gain, but just honoring that space in between. Now, two members of a very contentious issue in America, abortion, did just this. The pro-life and the pro-choice members in Boston came together because there had been a shooting in a Planned Parenthood. And so they began meeting in secret, and they learned to tone down their inflammatory language, and they began speaking together deeply about how they and why they believed and what they believed. Now, after a few years, they discovered that when there were more threats, it was the pro-life people who warned the pro-choice people about it, and they learned to create a united front when there were other threats coming along. They started working together. So at the end of this time, they held a press conference and told the press what they'd been doing in secret. And one of the press said to them, "So who won the debate?" And both sides said, "No one did, because we now believe even more firmly what we believed, because we've expressed it so deeply." And so the reporter then said, "So it was a failure then, huh?" And they said, "Oh, no, no, no. Now you see, we go out together. We party together. We watch each other's children. We love each other." And you see, what they had learned to do was honor that space in between. And when they put the relationship first and allowed themselves to feel the connection that's always there, underneath whatever beliefs there are, they found that they could connect even when basic worldviews collide. And you see, what happens in that circumstance is a thing called, scientists call it limbic resonance, which means when you connect in that deep way, your brainwaves start operating in sync. You create a deeper connection in that space in between than you do normally when you're just talking about and agreeing on some sort of belief, because that kind of connection transcends differences.
This is certainly world of vision. I like to finish with the thought I have started. I believe that your book is an institution, and to make a little luxury of the fantasy, I feel that this book certainly can be foundation to create an institution where certain subjects would be added to regular academic curriculum to bring our young children, then teenagers, and then young adults much more prepared to the modern world with its challenges, with its necessary modification, and most important, to find his and her own place as a connection. And I wanted to thank you, my very talented visionary and author, who certainly made huge statement in the world at a time when it's greatly needed. And again, I wanted to thank you personally, Lynn, to find the time in your very creatively hectic schedule and to have this discussion, which is extremely memorable.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Nina. It's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. And I did want to let your readers know that they can come on my website to find out more. And it's www.thebond.net. And they can find there, if they sign up, they can get a free portion of the book. They can read the introduction, which you were so impressed with.
I thank you so much for this conclusion. In fact, I was going to offer, but you kindly presented in much more clear way. I'm sure it will be visited many times, and I wanted to say welcome to America. We cannot wait to see you here, and thank you for your statement and for sharing your world with the world.
Thank you so much, Lena. It's been my pleasure.
And that was my another edition of Lena Live. I'm Lena Mirmond. I will talk to you with more sharing next week. Have a thoughtful and caring time.